Hello and welcome to Everyone's an Expert with me, Dr. Alex D. I'm a musician and music educator and I recently got my PhD where my area of research was the analysis of pop songs. Now we generally recognise a PhD as a form of recognition that someone is an expert in something. But recently I was thinking about the futility of being a supposed expert in pop music. One of the great things about pop music is its universality and the fact that success in pop is dictated by audiences. Essentially, no one person's opinion about pop music is more important than another's, no matter how many degrees you've got. Either everyone's an expert, or no one is. I prefer the former. Through my career so far, I've been lucky to come across lots of people in the music industry who do amazing and varied things. I also think that sometimes the most insightful stuff that is said or written about music comes from people that don't play or write it. So, the gist of this podcast is me talking to interesting people in music, or interesting people about music. I hope you enjoy listening, and if you want to get in touch about anything that comes up in this series, then tweet me at AlexDavidD, or send a message to the same handle on Instagram. My first guest is UK trumpeter, arranger and conductor Matt Roberts. Matt is a supremely talented and versatile musician I first met at Leeds College of Music in the mid-noughties when we were both studying jazz there. One of the things that always struck me about Matt, other than being a great player, was his enthusiasm and warmth. I think you'll see what I mean when you listen to our chat. Enjoy! Matt, welcome to Everyone's an Expert. Thanks for coming on, mate.
Hey, Alex, how you doing? Great to see you, man. It's been a little while.
I know. I feel like we sort of bump into each other on semi-regular basis, but that's probably with years in between, isn't it?
Yeah. Many years. Like yeah.
But you're back to it. So I'm catching you at the back end of a Gentleman's Dub Club tour, right?
That's right, yeah. So apologies to any of your listeners. I'm feeling a bit croaky. And that's because I'm staving off a tour cold, you know. And anyone who's been, you know, extensive stints on the road knows that at the end of a tour, you often come back with a bit of a cold from sleep deprivation, substance consumption.
celebrating a successful performance.
That's right, yeah. And also, you know, I guess being in a room with thousands of people. So it's one of them, but the COVID test is negative, so we're all good on that front at least.
That's good to know. Well, I mean, we're hundreds of miles away from one another, so I'm feeling safe. So yeah, I mean, it looked from the social media standpoint like it was a successful tour. Is that kind of your first stint with that band back in?
Pretty much, yeah. We did some festivals in the summer of 2021. But no, this tour that we just completed was postponed, I think, twice. So I think this was originally going to be in March 2021. And of course, in March 2020 was when the pandemic hit. And I remember us having that conversation of, God, oh, but surely the tour in March 2021 will be fine. You know, that it'll all be sorted by then, surely. But of course, you know, there was deep in some big wave then. So yeah, that we had to postpone. I think we initially postponed it to the autumn. And then again, you know, things weren't right for then. So it got postponed to March. And even then we thought, God, maybe this won't happen because of this Omicron wave that kicked off and whooped everyone's ass. But no, it happened. And I think the timing of it was actually pretty good. We shifted loads of tickets. Most of the gigs sold out. Great to see some young people there, you know, 18, 19 year olds who this will have been their first Gentleman's Dub Club live experience because of course.
Yeah, I mean, how long? 15 years, something like that? Less than that, or is it around about that?
That's a good question. Maybe slightly less, maybe kind of like 13. I'm not really sure, to be honest. But yeah, it's been going a little while,
you guys. It's
relevant.
More the success of having a project that's independent and has just grown.
Yeah, no, 100%. No, I mean, we've been very lucky. I mean, having said that, we have worked hard, but
of course, yeah.
I mean, we were even having this discussion the other day about how I couldn't do what we did with Gentleman's Dub Club now again, because you know, we started it when we were students. I mean, we started it just as a fun thing, jamming in a friend's basement. Then we'd just do these little informal performances at house parties. Then we did our first live performance at mine in the Students' Union in Leeds
oh,
Uni.
Oh, yeah.
And then started to stretch out outside of Leeds, you know, Sheffield, Manchester, hitting all the uni towns basically in the north. And then as we were developing our vocalist, who's a promoter when he's not doing Gentleman's Dub Club things, he was developing connections with all these uni towns, you know, with other promoters that were putting on events, making connections in Cardiff, in Bristol, in London, in Brighton. And yeah, we were just, but man, we were slogging it, man. You know, we were doing, you know, we were walking away with 20 quid a gig sometimes, you know, it just is what it is. And that's fine when you're a student, you know, to some extent, but you know, now starting a new project, getting a new project off the ground, you can't ask that of musicians, because of course we're all professionals now, and this is how we, you know, it's our bread and butter, and this is how we pay our bills. So, yeah, no,
it's such an unusual thing, that, isn't it? Because it really is true with a project like that, that is driven by, I guess, passion, and there's original music involved, and it has a sense of identity. It kind of has to grow that way organically, doesn't it, in order for it to get to the point that you guys are at with it. You can't really fast forward that or fake it.
Yeah, no, you can't. I mean, occasionally there's a thing of labels signing up solo artists and putting a lot of money behind them, but I just find that's happening less and less. You know, I mean, when we were growing up, I don't know how old you are, Alice, but when I was growing up in the 90s and being a musician, starting bands, this and the other, there was very much this thing of, oh, you know, when you get signed, that's all your problems are over, you know, and actually that's when your problems begin. And these days, but there was, you know, labels had money back then, and they could just, if they decided something was amazing, they could just pump hundreds of thousands of pounds into a project and get it in rotation on the radio, just get it in people's ears and make a thing happen. But now labels are just so risk averse. They really wait for you to be established, and then they approach you and want to get a cut of it. So yeah, I feel that the catapulting someone into fame thing happens less and less, and really, yeah, you know, with original music, it's people are slugging it, and as we did for years. But you know, it did pick up. I mean, that when things the big turning point for us was getting on the festival circuit. You know, we're so lucky in this country to have this culture of summer festivals, because it just means that if you're on that circuit, you can just play to thousands of people, thousands of people in just, yeah, 2 or 3 months, and the fees are good. You know, there's money. These festivals have budget, and you can get decent fees. And there was I remember the first, I've got to shout out the Chai Waller stage, who was
right,
as one of those independent stages that goes around. You know, at festivals there'll be the official, you know, the official Glastonbury stages, the Pyramid stage, the John Peel stage, the whatever, the Park stage, and then there'll be, God, tens, hundreds even of smaller independent stages, and they'll basically approach Glastonbury and be like, look, this is what we offer. We'll program this kind of music. We do drinks, we do food, and we need this, you know, square meters of space, and we need this budget from you, and festivals will throw a bit of money at them, and they'll spend a whole season doing, you know, 10, 11, 12 different festivals. And we were lucky, we got in with the folks at Chai Waller, who are, I think, Bristol based. I'm not sure if they're still going, but yeah, and they loved us, and they booked us on every festival they were doing that season, which was about 10 or 12. So yeah, we got to play to 1,000 people that summer. And the difference we noticed from then, our headline gigs before and after that festival stint, was just enormous. And then the following summer, we did another stint of festivals. And again, our headline shows, our autumn tour that we were doing after that summer, the ticket prices the attendance was, yeah, maybe doubled again, and we just built it up that way, and every year we could see this improvement. So that was really reassuring and really kept us driving and knowing that we were onto a bit of a winner, really. And you know, the other key thing is that we're really enjoying ourselves, you know, and we all get on. I mean, especially at the moment, the vibe in the band's never been so good. And yeah, so yeah, we're all having a good time. And that's really important because, you know, now people have got kids, you know, people have got kids, people
right,
have got
yeah.
mortgages, you know, people have got other projects they've got going on. So if it wasn't enjoyable and if it wasn't wasn't economically sustainable, then, you know, the band would fall apart. But no, things are really good in Gentleman's Dub Club camp at the moment, I have to say.
That's great. I'm glad you bring up the thing about the festival thing as well, because sometimes people can be, I don't know, that concept of being a festival act for some people is problematic. But what's struck me, I mean, the times that I've watched you guys has been at festivals, what struck me is that because of the energy that you guys put out and because of the way that you kind of present on stage, the music's great and super catchy, but you don't necessarily need to have been a fan already to get into the live performance.
100%.
It's one of the things that would have been appealing for festival bookers for you guys in the first place, was that, well, we can book these guys and they're going to entertain whoever is in front of them. But then turning that into a fan base that comes out deliberately to see you is a different matter. So it's what an achievement to kind of tick both those boxes, really, for a long time.
Thanks, man. Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you. I think you're dead on it. I think we're the kind of act that, yeah, you can enjoy having never heard any of our studio releases. And I think for that reason, if you know what it's like, if you've been to a festival as a punter, as I did many times growing up, and, you know, you're all sat around the tent planning the day and the acts you're going to see. And, you know, you can just imagine people being like, got to come and see Gentleman's Dub Club. You know, you don't matter if you don't know the music, just come and see them, you'll enjoy them. And it's just a word of mouth thing, you know. And then those people that then see us next time they're at the festivals next year, they're saying the same thing to their mates, and it just spreads like that. So no, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And no, we have no shame of being a quote-unquote festival band. No, it's, that's us in our element, really. So no, the festivals have been really good to us, thank goodness for that. And you know, it's quite a British thing. I'm not saying there's not summer festivals elsewhere, but you know, in Britain there's so many, and of course Britain's a small country relatively speaking, so you can get about, you can string together three, even four festivals in a weekend, and then just that weekend play to, you know, tens of thousands of people. Whereas, you know, in America, you'd have to be taking flights between those performances. You know, we don't have to do that here. You know, we've got so many student towns, uni towns, just big, well-populated cities that can command the existence of a festival of a decent size every weekend of the summer. So it's really good. We're really lucky.
Awesome. So the other thing that I saw recently you were at was with a different hat on. I can't remember whether it was Queen Elizabeth Hall or Festival Hall, forgive me, but you
Festival
were
Hall.
Conducting a pretty big concert the other day, so from festival to Festival Hall. Tell me about that.
So,
I mean, in terms of what that particular gig was, what led you to conducting, because like, it's a tiny, tiny percentage of musicians that have that skill set in their wheelhouse.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, no, so that was me conducting the London Concert Orchestra at the Royal Festival Hall. And we were doing a program of Frank Sinatra music.
Big time.
It was brilliant. I mean, you know, all the arrangements, the charts were immaculately transcribed by the incredible Callum Au, who is one of the best arrangers, one of the best musicians, frankly. His trombone playing is unbelievable, but one of the best arrangers in the country, in the world, potentially. I mean, you know, this guy does stuff for the Metropole Orchestra, does stuff for all the big UK orchestras. Anyhow, but these were transcriptions he did when he was a student, you know, of all the Nelson Riddle, Billy Mayer, Quincy Jones arrangements that were done for Frank. all Donkey Kong.
Yeah, I mean, just as a tangent, as an arranger, it's one thing to have... Well, I mean, it's not one thing. It's an incredible thing to have a voice and a style as an arranger. And I mean, we'll talk to you about, you know, you as an arranger as well. But to also be able to turn on the dial, whether it's transcriptions or write something in a style as well. I've heard a lot of his arrangements. There's such a range. It's not just one voice or style, is it?
Absolutely not. No, he's a genius. But I think one thing that we'll probably come onto in this chat is how all these things feed into each other, you know. and that's really the story of me getting into conducting. So you and I met at Leeds College of Music, where I was studying jazz. Were you on jazz or pop, Alex?
Yeah, I was on jazz. I think I was the year below you. Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah,
I graduated in 2009.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so I graduated in 2008. That's right, yeah. Did you have George Grant in your year?
Yeah, yeah. I was with like George, Russell Henderson, Alex Moore, Peter Lee, all these guys. Oh, it was a great year, actually.
It really was. Yeah, no, I still see George Grant. I still see Pete Lee. Pete Lee's doing
Sam
great.
Vickery, Ali Mack. I'm trying to list all my friends before they get annoyed at me.
Well, look, listen to that. Sam Vickery plays with Cinematic Orchestra. Pete Lee plays with Tom Walker. You know, it's incredible, isn't it, how the peers that you were with at college and you're thinking, oh, God, are we going to amount to much? We do go on to do good things. It is amazing. And I mean, if there's any music students listening to this who are studying at Leeds College of Music or any of the other music colleges, my advice is, you know, just stick with your community, stick with the people in your year who are serious about music, because, you know, you will see each other smash it, basically. You know, it's great.
It's a really gratifying thing, isn't it? I remember, I think it was 2017. There was a bunch of us at Glastonbury with that London Electricity big band. Because I think one of the last times I bumped into you was at one of the hospitality festivals that you guys were at with Gentleman's Dub Club. That was great because there were so many of us in that. But then bumping into people like Chris Hargreaves at the festival, you know, and Sam Vickery was playing there that year. And you do, yeah, you look around, you go, wow, we were all at some point sat in a room all together at college.
That's right.
Been, you know, sort of 10 years before that.
Yeah, and learning what a 251 was for the first
time. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Brilliant. Anyway, yeah, so... I was there, studied jazz, loved it. I mean, loved my time at Leeds College of Music. I can't speak highly enough of that institution and the teachers that were there then. And, you know, I know the teachers who were there now and they're all amazing. So, you know, enough love for Leeds College of Music. But yeah, I was there studying jazz. Had a great time, you know, really was really into the playing, of course. But I have to say that there was a point, I think it was as I became aware of the standard that existed in London of jazz musicians in London. I knew Reuben Fowler, who'd just gone down to do an undergrad at Royal Academy. I did a project called the Conservatoires UK Big Band that featured, you know, people like Freddie Gavita, George Hogg. I'm missing trumpet players specifically here. And then, of course, the great Rich Turner, who sadly passed away far too young, but he was a good friend of mine. I mean, he was from Leeds originally. I used to get lessons with him when he was back up. And, you know, he was just absolutely mind-blowing. And I just thought, do you know what? I love playing and I love transcribing solos and I love learning tunes. And I will continue to do that, but it won't be my contribution. My contribution to the scene, to the music, will not be as a jazz trumpet player, because there's just so many incredible jazz trumpet players out there. And, you know, when I moved to London, then I discovered Laura Judd, and now there's Alex Ridout and James Corpus and all these unbelievable jazz trumpet players. It is just unbelievable. So I think I made the right decision. I still really enjoy playing jazz and I still do it. I'm at Ronnie Scott's on Wednesday night hosting The Late Show. So I'm still very involved in that. But in terms of, yeah,
the thing is, you're comparing yourself as well to some of the best trumpet players in Europe, the world.
Exactly.
Probably, aren't you? I mean, this is the thing.
No, totally. And that's the London scene. It's just unbelievable. Yeah, yeah. You know, yeah, I mean, it is incredible. So anyway, whatever. And so I knew that the stuff that I was really into, and I thought, you know, but what I am really good at is arranging, is composition. all that kind of thing. And so I really wanted to get into that. But then the thing is, my musical upbringing before Leeds College of Music, I grew up in a town called Darlington, and I came through the kind of northern brass band scene. And for any of your listeners who aren't aware of that scene, it's this incredible culture, deep, deep culture that exists around the northeast, Yorkshire, parts of Manchester, northwest, parts of Wales. I think there's a few brass bands in Somerset, and it's all linked to where there was coal mines. And there was lots of coal mines in Durham, even though Darlington itself wasn't a mining town. There was lots of pits in Durham, and each of these pits would have their own brass bands. And that's how I really learned music, learned how to play initially the cornet and the flugelhorn, and then later got into trumpet in my teens. And that's how I learned to read music. So it's a classical training in the sense that we were reading notation and we were trying to play things accurately and in tune and that kind of thing. But it wasn't classical upbringing in the sense that we were playing Mahler and Mozart and Beethoven. You know, it was marches and hymns, basically, is the repertoire of brass bands, and some really hip contemporary music as well. But I wanted to get into the writing. I was quite serious about the writing, but I'd never even sat in an orchestra. I'd never even sat in an ensemble with stringed instruments, for example, or with a proper woodwind section, you know, with oboes and coronglés and bassoons and that kind of thing. You know, it was, of course, in a big band, in a jazz orchestra, you'll have saxophone players doubling on, often reluctantly doubling on flute and clarinet and bass clarinet and all that stuff. But no, I'd never sat in an orchestra properly. And so I hadn't heard these sounds. I wasn't really into listening to classical music, if I'm completely honest. I mean, the jazz course at Leeds did turn me on to, you know, Debussy, Ravel, Stockhausen, people, classical music.
Did you study with Graham Hearn at all?
I did study with Graham Hearn.
Did you do his early 20th century module?
I didn't do that much. In fact, I don't think that module existed. Maybe not. I'm not sure.
I picked it by accident when I was in my second year because I thought it was early 20th century jazz, and it wasn't. But it was mind. But it was amazing. That what a heavy, heavy.
Well, yeah. Look,
genius
don't,
dude.
Don't
yeah.
get me
sorry,
started,
but I'm derailing you. But like,
no. Oh look, Graham Hearn.
What a guy.
No. He Graham Hearn was my route to a lot of that music. He was my one-on-one composition mentor
amazing.
My third year.
Right.
And he turned me on to all kinds of stuff. And also before that, in first year even, just James Taylor, just showing us where did Bill Evans get that quartal voicing from So What? Where did he get that from? He didn't just pick it out of thin air. He got it from Debussy and Ravel and all that stuff, you know, and that's where all that quartal stuff came from. It was just learning about it through that and then retrospectively going back, listening, go, oh, okay, wow, okay, check out these piano preludes by Debussy. Wow, incredible. Check out this Ravel string quartet, you know, check out Bartok, you know. It was all that stuff. But really, I wasn't steeped into it. And so I knew I had to plug that gap if I was serious about writing, you know, especially writing for strings and stuff. You know, the writing for strings is such a deep art form. There's so much going on, so much to assimilate. So I knew if I was serious about that, I had to do some further studying. At the same time, I was studying privately with a wonderful jazz composer called Izzy Barrett. She actually exchanged lessons. She taught me for free in exchange for me doing her copying. So she'd send me like parts, score and parts to copy. And then when she was up in Leeds, we'd have a lesson. And it worked really well. Anyhow, she was actually responsible for starting the jazz course at Trinity, but she is a composer first and foremost. And so it kind of, there was this coalescing of, okay, I'm studying with this composer who teaches at Trinity. I'd heard things about the Trinity College of Music department that it was disciplined. You know, you had to get your shit together in terms of orchestration and this, that, and the other. But at the same time, it was open-minded enough that I would be able to still write for improvisers, still write for jazz musicians and that kind of thing. which is exactly what I wanted. It was also a time when Gentleman's Dub Club, we were all moving down to London, so I was able to move down and keep all that work, because, you know, anyone, you know, you might not know, but know this, Alex, but there were times, you know, towards the end of my time at Leeds, that I'd looked above me in the kind of senior members of the scene there, some of whom had tried to move down to London and had kind of come back up a year later with their tail between their legs and not really being able to make it work. And I actually think it's a really hard thing to do if you don't have a route in. And obviously, if you study at a music college, that really is really helpful, because it immediately plants you in a community of people who can pass you work and this, that, and the other. I was lucky because I was going down not to do a performance course. So in many ways, I wasn't going to get that. But I got to keep most of the work I was doing via Gentleman's Dub Club, via a few kind of bread and butter function gigs.
I was going to say, there was quite a lot of the guys that we'd have been studying with that was kind of moved down together, I guess, guys like Hugh and Ali and...
100%. All those guys. We all basically moved down together. So I got to keep almost all the work I was doing. I was very, very fortunate, you know. And, you know, yeah, as I say, I've seen some of the best players I've ever heard try and move down to London and not make it work. But I was able to make it work just through very fortuitous circumstances. So anyhow, so yeah, I came down and started studying at Trinity, and immediately was just getting absolutely roasted on the classical thing. I mean, you wouldn't believe it. It just became almost like a running joke, you know. They'd be like, you know, Matt, whistle me the second subject in the third movement of Mozart Piano Concerto in A. And I'd just be like, absolutely out of the question. But yeah, I'm telling you right now.
Not possible. Yeah.
Not possible. Everyone in that room would be able to do that. And they, you know, he'd say, okay.
Oh, man.
Yeah, yeah. He'd be like, okay, we're listening to the overture to The Flying Dutchman by Wagner. Incredible opera. Begins with a storm. Can anyone else name a storm, an opera that begins with a storm from this period? And he's like, Matt. No. And he's like, okay, anyone else? And the whole room's got their hand up, you know. And then someone's like, ooh, Peter Grimes. And he's like, oh, that wasn't even the one I was thinking of. But yes, you're right. Anyone else? And then what's the other one? And everyone knew it. And I just had this feeling of, oh my goodness, I've got so much work ahead of me to kind of get stuck into. But let me tell you this, my knowledge of harmony was way beyond and anyone on that course, and that is just the reality of being a jazz musician. You know, jazz really is the most harmonically advanced music. Really, you know, you can't even think about playing jazz without knowing, you know, all the standard functional progressions. And then also, you know, if you're doing anything post, you know, 60s and onwards, you've really got to know all your stuff about all the modes, limited transposition, this, that, and the other as well. You know, so. It was interesting.
It's even the way that theory is discussed is quite different between those disciplines, isn't it? You would think it's the same 12 notes. It's the you know, you have the same. The sounds aren't genre specific, because you mentioned that people like Bill Evans are borrowing from Ravel and Debussy. But I've found this working with my PhD supervisor. We'd be talking about the same thing, but we'd kind of be speaking almost a different language sometimes. You know, trying to talk about. Richness of harmony, or you know, even talking about vertical and horizontal, he was like, what are you on about?
I'm like, wow.
Well, oh, what, that, okay, right, I really need to go back to basics here, because we you know, we'd be drawing the same conclusions, but a lot of the, even the vocabulary that I think we would use coming through a certain style of study in jazz, it's really interesting how it's different, even though you're using the same finite set of pitches.
No, 100%. You know, yeah, I mean, there's all people start talking to me in figured bass and I'm just switching off, because I'm like, oh my goodness, people are still using that system. Yeah, no, you're right. And you just have to learn to translate. Oh, they're talking about a 6-4 chord. What's that? Oh, yeah, it's a triad in second inversion or something. You know, it's like, oh my goodness. But yeah, no, it was crazy. But I'm not even talking about that per se. It was really just the thing of just the repertoire, man. It was just the repertoire, yeah. The history, you know, Schumann. What period is Schumann? What were Schumann's major works? You know, Dvorak, who's he? You know, where's he from? You know, sing me one of his themes, you know. It was just all that stuff. But so, you know, on top of the demands of the course and on top of trying to, you know, create my own voice as a composer, on top of trying to make a living in London, I was every single week, I'd pick, there was an incredible deal at the festival hall at that time, I hope it's still going, where you could see the RPO as a student for £4. So every week that I was available, I'd buy these £4 tickets and it would be like, right, what are they doing this week? All right, they're doing Sibelius 6. Okay, right, go to the college library, get out the score. That's my score for today. And I'd just get inside it, pick out any interesting orchestration combinations. Oh, wow, look at the way he's dovetailed the oboes and the flutes here. Ah, that's really interesting. And, oh, okay, who's on the top of the voicing? Okay, got that. Oh, interesting. He's got the filing ones and twos in unison up here. Oh, okay, right, you know, this, that, and the other. Picking all of that stuff out. Read it. Right, when was this written? Is this early Sibelius? Is this late Sibelius? Yeah, where is Sibelius from? You know, like, what other composers are from that country? You know, just trying to get inside this music as quickly as possible. And I did that for 2 years. And that was just purely extracurricular. But I knew that's what I had to do to kind of catch up with these lot, you know. But again, you know, I do have this theory that I was having this conversation because I'm now back teaching at the composition faculty at Trinity, which is a real, real honour. And we had a faculty meeting the other day, and I was having a debate with this the orchestration teacher that taught me, incredible musician called Stephen Montague, amazing American post-minimalist composer, and his orchestration lessons were really inspirational to me. And, you know, a real, real hard ass, you know, he'd just be like, right, what, this point at someone, right, what's the lowest note on a piccolo? Right, okay. Right, well, is this glissando on a trombone possible? You know, just that's it. You know, is this double stop possible on the viola? You know, just constant bombard you, and then, you know, if you didn't have the right answer, he'd whoop your ass. You know, he'd just be like, right, you know, are you serious about this? Come on, like we looked at the score last week. You know, anyhow, really interesting, and he also was really interesting about, you know, talking about things that even the big composers got wrong. You know, it's like, oh, you know, in Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique, he tries to write triads for the timpani. Does it work? No, it sounds like shit. and you know, he'd be like, oh, look at this score. The composer tried to write a diminished scale for the harp. Not possible. You know, not. And he was brilliant. You know, absolutely brilliant teacher. Anyhow, and we were debating, you know, what's the hardest instrument, family of instruments, to write for? And he was saying, oh, it's strings because, you know, they have all these string-specific techniques, sul ponticello, where you bow near the bridge, sul tasto, flottando, like tremolo, you know, adding the mute. There's all these different textures, you know, all the infinite ways you could bow something. And then, of course, within that, you know, how do you group the section, this, that, and the other, divisi, you know, what's the most optimal way of divisiing a particular chord, this, that, and the other. But I was disagreeing. I was like, I think that the hardest instrument set to write for is the brass family, because all that stuff you've said you can teach and you can learn, and it's all in an orchestration book. But the thing about brass is you have to think about stamina, the stamina of the players. You know, it's like, okay, is that note playable? Yes. Is it playable as a long note for 4 bars? No. Is it playable as a long note for 2 bars at pianissimo? No. You know, but is it playable for forte as a crotchet after 8 bars rest? Yes. You know, it's like all these things of nuance of like the physicality of brass playing. If you're not a brass player, I think are incredibly hard to learn. And I think that's a reason why a lot of the great arrangers like Quincy Jones, like Vince Mendoza is a hobbyist trumpet player. He told me that. I got to have some drinks with Vince Mendoza, one of my absolute idols.
Oh, wow.
He told me, I had no idea that he's a trumpeter. Callum Auser, who we were talking about earlier, is a trombonist. You know, I think there's a reason why a lot of the big arrangers are brass players, because we just intuitively understand that. And I think that's very, very hard to learn. So, you know, within this composition faculty at Trinity, I was finding that, okay, I'm really weak on repertoire, and really weak. I mean, to be honest, I still am weak, if I'm completely honest. You know, it's just, I didn't, these people have got years on me, you know.
Also, you've only got so much brain space, because you wouldn't yeah. be expecting those people to know everything that you would know about the tradition of jazz, you know.
Of course. No, totally. But so, yeah, I was fine. I was weak on repertoire, this and the other, but that everyone was bringing their brass parts to me. Matt, is, have a look at this. How hard is this? I'm like, whoa, you're asking a lot of your French horn player here. Oh, I'm not sure if that trombonist got enough time to take that mute out, you know, this kind of thing. So it was really interesting. But I had loads of performance opportunities, got to write string quartets, got to write for orchestra twice, got to write choral music, you know, really amazing. All these opportunities that I'd never had before in terms of writing.
Wait, so, and when you say got to do that, you mean actually have that work realized?
Absolutely,
a quick
yeah,
turnaround yeah. by great musicians.
Exactly, yeah. Rehearsed, performed, recorded, which is how you learn, let me tell you that much. I mean, I remember the first time I got to write for orchestra, and it was one of the first times, really, that I had writer's block. I generally don't ever get writer's block. But I was really, it was just the options. It's like, right, you got a melody, okay, this could be played by the violins, violas, cello, even double bass. It could be played by the oboe. It could be played by the clarinet. It could be played by the flute. It could be played by the trumpet. It'd be at the top of the register, but it could be played by a trombone. You know, you're sat there thinking, and then within that, any combination of all of these possible textures. And also the difference between an oboe and a trumpet is massive. The difference between a clarinet and a flute and a viola is massive, whereas in a big band you've basically got two textures. You've got trumpet and trombone, which are still a kind of that same brassy sound, really. You know, you can't compare the difference between those two to say the difference between an oboe and a flute, you know, completely different sound.
Yeah, sure.
That anyone can tell the difference with. And the saxophone family, which of course are very homogenous and blend really well. So really you've only got two textures, and even really, in the scheme of things, that those two textures aren't all that different compared to, you know, the variety you have within an orchestra. So I was really struggling, and I was going deep into all these scores. Or what did Ravel do, and what did Debussy do, what did Wagner do, like all the great orchestrators, and how did they solve this problem? And but the thing is, and I spent so much time swatting up on it, and I had this score. But let me tell you right now, I learned more from the downbeat of the first downbeat of the rehearsal. In the first 10 seconds of that, I learned more in those 10 seconds than I did from weeks of studying scores, hours and hours and hours of studying scores. The way you learn, and I stress this to anyone who might be listening who's interested in writing, in orchestration, for kind of live musicians, just get your stuff played. That's how you learn. And immediately you just go, oh God, yeah, flute can't project in that range, getting completely drowned out. Yeah, that was stupid, should be an octave higher. You're just immediately like, oh, that shouldn't have put the trombone on the ninth. It's sticking out like a sore thumb, you know, whatever. You just immediately just hear these and learn these lessons. But you only have to learn the lesson once, because you never make those mistakes again. And that's it. And what I would say is, as a arranger and composer, the journey you go on is learning the thing you had in your head versus the thing how it was in reality, and the disparity between those two things. And initially, when you first get the opportunity to write for a particular instrumentation, be it orchestra or big band, initially you're like, oh, this doesn't sound like how I thought it would. You know, that thing that I thought was going to sound great actually sounds terrible. But then sometimes you're pleasantly surprised. God, that thing I wasn't sure about, wow, that's really effective. Oh, great, I'll do that again.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you go through this process, and gradually there's less and less surprises. So now, you know, when I'm handing a score for an orchestra or a big band, there's basically no surprises. I know what I'm going to get. Yes, I will sometimes push the boat out and be like, oh, I'm asking a little bit of my musicians here. You know, this is going to require some rehearsal time. But then you factor that in, you go, but yeah, do you know what, the rest of this score is is just read straight down. So we can give 20 minutes to this little tricky thing that I want to try and do. So yeah, that's the journey that you go on as a orchestrator and arranger composer. And yeah, I was very lucky with Trini. Anyhow, so this is all a digression of you asking how I got into conducting.
This is the perfect kind of circuitous route I like to take. So
yeah, well, so getting into the conducting thing, while I was at Trinity, I started my own big band because I was very lucky. Straight, really, in the first semester of Trinity, there's this competition that I believe still exists called the John Dankwith Prize for Composition. And it's a composition prize for jazz, which I think is brilliant because actually as jazz musicians, we're really whipped into shape in terms of our playing and, you know, do we have enough language and do we know enough tunes and can we outline the changes and this, that, and the other. But, you know, there's often, I'd say, and there's a lot of, yeah, prizes for, you know, performance stuff, but it was great that this prize got set up to celebrate jazz composition. And of course I entered and I won in my first semester at Trinity. And mercifully the prize was, it was a cash prize. But the other thing was, is the piece got performed at Ronnie Scott's by Trinity College of Music Big Band. So I was just in the door at Trinity and had already had a big band's worth of really killing jazz musicians at the jazz department at Trinity, which was and still is a really, really strong jazz department. And they'd all played my chart and they'd all enjoyed it. And people came up to me afterwards saying, look, we'd love to play some more of your music. So, you know, just let us know, book a room and we'll do it. It was like, oh my God, brilliant. You know, so there it was. I started a big band in my first semester. And of course, you know, that requires rehearsal and someone to navigate the rehearsal and this and the other. Who's going to do that? Well, it might as well be me, you know. So I just, out of pure practical necessity, kind of learned how to, you know, beat a 4/4 shape as a conductor. And then it was like, oh, I've got this tune in 7. All right, now I need to learn how to beat in 7. And, oh, this tune's got a ral and this tune's got an accelerando. And then we've got a pause and we're going to bring them off the pause. And just gradually you're learning the physical thing of, you know, stick wagging, as we call it. And just kind of got it together. But more importantly, what I was getting together, and this is really what people always ask, you know, what does a conductor actually do? And the biggest thing the conductor does, of course, is MD the rehearsal, musical direct the rehearsal, decide, manage the often very, in this country, very limited rehearsal time, and decide, okay, it's that thing I was telling you about, the tricky, when you write something tricky in arrangement, just being able to look through the scores and go, okay, what's going to need attention? What isn't going to need attention? Okay, this will read straight down. We might not even have to run that. We could just do maybe one run read through or top and tail it, make sure the tempo's secure. Right, turn that one over. We've got bigger fish to fry because in this chart, we've got a really tricky thing that's going to take some time. And that decision-making, if it's mismanaged, can cost someone a lot of money. Because if it's for a recording session with a large ensemble, everyone's on union rates. The studio, by virtue of it being a large ensemble, has to be one of the big London studios, Abbey Road, Air Studios, Angel Studios, one of these big ones, Meadowvale. And you know, it's costing thousands of pounds every minute, you know. And so if you and overtime is not an option, you know. So you really got... That's the thing you really bring to the table as a conductor. And I was kind of, without knowing it, learning all those skills. And, you know, because the music I was writing was quite demanding. So that's where I really got those basic skills together. And word just got around, oh, yeah, there's this guy, Matt, who can, he understands jazz, he's a jazz musician, but he can conduct. And that in itself, if you imagine the Venn diagram of people, yeah, who understand, sure, the principles of jazz and rhythmic music in one circle and the people who can conduct, you would be surprised how little those two schools overlap. I mean, I've myself done what's called crossover projects. So crossover projects is just when an orchestra is playing not classical music, you know. And I'd done as a player, I'd sat in, I mean, you could call it orchestras if you want, but as I say, it's crossover orchestras. And I'd sat as a professional after Leeds in these orchestras, insane crossover projects get completely ruined because there was some conductor who was coming from a classical background and classical perspective who, I don't know, was trying to pull the tempo around on a dubstep thing or something like that. It's like, no, mate, you're not really understanding this. Like, this music, the tempo doesn't get pulled around. And once that beat drops, you are not responsible for the tempo, the drummer and the bassist are. So stop pulling this, thinking you can pull this around as if it's a Ravel, you know, string piece. This is not, rubato is not a thing in this music. And if you knew anything about the principles of this music, you'd know that, but you don't. And so just knowing the principles of rhythmic music, in the case of jazz, understanding, you know, being able to keep the form when everyone's improvising. You know, that you wouldn't believe how few people can do that. You know, if the musicians decide to stretch out, you know, can you cue that backing figure that's going to happen in 32 bars? You know, have you lost the form? Can you hear the harmony? Can you hear your way back in if they do start to, you know, stretch out? And anyway, whatever. And just by being able to do this and being able to, you know, conduct and do a solid managed rehearsal time, basically people, you know, it just started people asking me to do their finals. Oh, Matt, I'm doing a big band for my final. Would you be up for conducting it? Yeah, of course, man. Yeah, yeah. You know, and then, you know, friends would go out and get funding for some kind of ambitious crossover project and ask me to conduct that. And yeah, of course. And all of a sudden, okay, this is literally a professional conducting gig at this point. I'm getting paid to conduct.
It sort of tipped over into that point rather than you having an eye on the prize at any point.
100%. And then, oh man, and yeah, and just through that, really, I kind of became known, have some rep for being able to do that kind of thing and being somewhat of a go-to guy. I mean, look, don't get me wrong, there's other people out there that do it. But yeah, no, I mean, there's a lot of work for this at the moment. You know, there seems to be, just every week I see a new kind of crossover orchestra doing a drum and bass thing, doing a, you know, a dubstep thing, a hip hop thing, this and the other, and yeah, so there's a lot of that work out there now.
As you say, I think with the vast majority of those newer projects having an affinity and an understanding of the genre is more important. Well, not maybe not more important, but equally important to handling the orchestra. Rather than the other way around, right?
So of course it is. And the thing is that the learning of the handling of the orchestra, that can be learned. But to have a love for, you know, whatever, like the music
whatever
of Frank
it is,
Sinatra, yeah.
Yeah,
you know, the music of Sinatra that I was conducting with the London Concert Orchestra recently, it's like, you know, back in time to me starting Trinity, knowing nothing about, not nothing, but very little about the Western classical tradition. If you know, I shouldn't have stood in front of an orchestra conducting, you know, Mahler 5. You know, that would be a bad idea. and similarly, you shouldn't stick a classical conductor in front of a concert orchestra doing a program of Sinatra if they don't understand and have listened to that music either. You know, I think interesting concert orchestras are a really interesting thing. So concert orchestras, for any of your listeners who don't know, are basically a big band with a string orchestra attached. And notice I say that, not the other way around. It's not a string orchestra with a big band attached, which I think some people, they see a concert orchestra and that's what they think, because often the string orchestra will outnumber the big band because, you know, that to just to compete in terms of volume, you want to have 8, 10 first violins, you know, 10 first violins, 8 seconds, 6 violas, 4 celli, down that way. And that amounts to more people than in the big band. But make no mistake, it's a big band with a string orchestra attached. In terms of what's the principles of this music, I think it's more helpful to have a grounding in big band music than it is to have a grounding of classical music or the string orchestra repertoire, for example, when you're conducting a concert orchestra, because the time, you know, who supplies the time, who's, are there solos, are there improvised solos, this, that, and the other, all of that is coming from the big band tradition. You know, think of the arrangers who've written for that lineup, you know, they're all come from a big band jazz background. So yeah, again, you know, I do feel like that I am quite well suited to conduct a project like that. So anyhow, it's been amazing, and I've ended up conducting all kinds of orchestras all over the world. You know, I've done the Lebanese National Symphony Orchestra, done the United Strings of Europe, Royal Northern Sinfonia, London Concert Orchestra, did the Manchester Concert Orchestra in May. So I've been very, very lucky with these opportunities. But having said that, I do think that myself, and I have to say a lot of other, there's some other great jazz musicians who are getting into directing now, and I do think these are the gigs that we should be doing, and I think the classical people should kind of stay in their lane unless they're really serious about understanding this music and understanding the principles of rhythmic music and improvised music.
Awesome. Well, listen, Matt, it's been absolutely brilliant chatting with you, catching up. Thanks so much for your time. It's been really brilliant. Thanks a lot, mate.
Alex, it's been an absolute pleasure. Great to see you. I know you're doing wonderful things. I always see on social media. And yeah, no, it's been really good to chat. And yeah, I hope your listeners find this useful.
Well, there you go. I hope you enjoyed listening to that chat with Matt. My next guest will be Scottish violinist Laura McMillan. So make sure to check that out next week when that comes along. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch, please do. Love to hear from you. Look forward to speaking to you soon. Cheers. Bye now.